It's probably not the worst award the National Hockey League gives out every postseason, Merrick. That remains the nebulous and repetitive Mark Messier Leadership Award, which is
there just so it can procure a sponsor.
Well, there to procure
they're
a sponsor,
just so
also,
we can sell sponsorship.
Right, but also so Messier can get a trip to Vegas and have his name on some award. And also so Sid can win something when he doesn't win anything else. It's also that's the reason also exists.
Okay.
It's the give Sidney something when there's nothing else to get. So I imagine he'll probably get that. But I also think that Sid's going to get the Lindsay, but that's besides the point. Yeah, the second worst award every postseason, without question, is the National Hockey League GM of the Year Award. The first reason it sucks is because we call it the National Hockey League General Manager of the Year Award. It doesn't actually have a cool name. Why is that?
I don't know. There are two obvious candidates for the name. One would be Sam Pollock, architect of those great Montreal Canadiens teams. But the other one, which I personally think it should be, not just because I think he did the most as general manager starting from expansion, but also because the award itself would look probably it would probably be the coolest looking award you could give out because it would be a bow tie. That's the Bill Torrey Award. I would just love for this to be presented and have someone come up and get a statue of a Bill Torrey-esque bow tie. That should be that should be the GM of the year.
My own theory on this is that you have so many old MFers in this league who are still general managing teams that were contemporaries of Bill Torrey at some point that they don't want to give the guy credit. They don't want to put his name on the award because, my name should be they should call it the Slats Award.
Greg, petty feuds are reserved for the Hall of Fame. Thank you very much.
True.
They're not
that's
reserved
well,
for this. So it's
well,
for
the that's
Hall
the
of
other
Fame.
That's the other thing about this award. The award is voted on by a vote was conducted among 30 club general managers and a panel of NHL executives, print and broadcast media. I think I know Kevin Allen is one of the print guys that votes on this thing. But what a nebulous formula. What gets weighed more? Do the GMs get weighed more? Does the spiffy panel get weighed more? It really is one of these awards where you're like scratching your head as to who's voting on it. But beyond
Doug
that,
McLean, by the way, Doug McLean is one of the people that votes on it as well.
Well, there you go. There's probably people out there.
It's funny. It's funny because I was asking Doug, we were talking about it last week at Sportsnet, and I said, well, what's the criteria? And we just kind of looked at each other and shrugged our shoulders.
Right.
Was good this year. But we'll get into what it means to be a general manager year in and year out. But sorry, continue your
point is well taken. And in Doug's case, I'm sure there's people out there that hear Doug McLean was one of the people selecting the GM of the year, and they're like, why? Yeah, it's like Harry Milbury is selecting GM of the year in the eyes of some people. I'm not a Doug McLean
hater,
per se.
But Mike would be qualified to.
Because he was a GM.
But Mike would be totally, yeah, absolutely. So is Doug. Absolutely.
Brian Lawton. All these guys.
Another one.
For sure. They don't all have to be Ken Holland selecting the GM of the year. They could be guys that maybe can recognize the struggles of a GM as much as the triumphs of a GM.
The Professional Hockey Writers Association, do you make a distinction between good writers and, I don't know, average writers?
Not at all.
Great writers allowed to vote?
Listen, man, I've been in that room.
Or are they all great?
I could say there ain't no distinction being made. hell, I'm in there, so you know, don't let anybody in. But your criteria argument, sir, is the real crux of the problem here with the general manager of the year. By the way, we've buried the lead here. Mark Bergevin of the Montreal Canadiens, Bob Murray of the Anaheim Ducks, and Ray Shearer of the Pittsburgh Penguins, the nominees for GM of the year. The criteria is non-existent. They never really established what the criteria is. It seems to be an award based on one regular season's worth of work, but also stretching back to the previous offseason. So, in other words, Bob Murray signing Victor Fast last May counts towards him being a GM of the year for 2013 because he also signed a couple of defensemen and he also signed Perry and Getzlaf after those big contracts, so he gets his name on the ballot based on that. However, again, like we've said before with this ridiculous award, how do you possibly judge the effectiveness of a general manager based on an 82-game regular season? First of all, it should go to the guy who builds a champion. We assume it could be Ray Shiro, but it sure as shit ain't Bergevin or Murray. Not this year. They're both out in one. And the other thing is, these things take time to incubate. Trades that involve draft picks, we don't know what those draft picks are until way down the line. You could take a 3-year sample of any general manager, and it probably still wouldn't be enough to properly measure whether or not this guy should be the general manager of the year, decade, millennia, what have you. It's a mind-numbing award.
It is the one position where you sit on the shoulders of those that came before. And, you know, the one example that, and even Brian Burke has gone out of his way to point this out. When he won the Stanley Cup in 2007, he went out of his way to say, a lot of this was built by Brian Murray. And a lot of this team is Brian Murray's team. And if you look back at last night, for example, or if you look at what's happened between the first 6 games between the Boston Bruins and the Toronto Maple Leafs, who's been the most important player for the Toronto Maple Leafs?
James Reimer.
Precisely. Now, Dave Nonis is the general manager right now. Many are pointing to Brian Burke and saying, wow, this is Brian Burke's team. His fingerprints are all over it. James Reimer is John Ferguson's. That's a John Ferguson pick. And there are a lot of players on that team, whether you're Leo Komarov or some of Carl Gunnarsson, some of the better defensive players on that squad that are John Ferguson players. So his fingerprints are still on this team as well. You know, the fans last night were chanting, thank you, Sagan. They should be chanting, thank you, Fergie, for James Reimer. Oh, and by the way, as a quick aside, because I want to get it out, is it not interesting that, you know, after being told in Toronto that Francois Allaire was the goaltending guru, he'll make all the goaltenders better, the first year that he leaves, all of a sudden James Reimer turns into an all-world goaltender. Anyway,
right.
Pause on that conversation. That goes on at another time. But the criteria for GM of the year in the NHL, to me, I don't know that you can pin one down. Or else you'd be awarding the general manager of the year to someone who may not even be a general manager employed that season.
It's
that's
true.
How insane, because, you know, when you look at when the Chicago Blackhawks won the Stanley Cup in 2010, I would have given GM of the year to Dale Talon, even though he didn't have a job.
Right. Because
that was his team. That was all of his heavy lifting.
But essentially what we're looking at here is what? We're looking at who wins the trade deadline or who was the guy who shepherded his team to the most surprising season. Now, listen, as asinine as I think this award is and how nebulous the criteria might be, if we're going to look at these three candidates, I think there's a clear winner. Would you agree?
A clear winner? Probably
yes.
Mark Bergevin. He did a lot this year and got the team from 15th to 2nd.
Now, I think they'll give it to Shiro because he managed to finagle Jerome Iginla and Brendan Morrow for peanuts at the trade deadline. I imagine that will be the determining factor for a lot of people. But in Bergevin's case, you know, say what you will about the Subban contract, and I know that Merrick has said his piece, and say what you will about the idea that signing Brandon Prust is like the biggest bold name on his resume as a general manager. But that Michel Therrien hiring, keep in mind the wheels fell off in the playoffs. We all agree on that.
Yeah.
You're talking about a guy who put his balls in the line hiring a retread who no one really likes to take over a team that looked like it could be headed towards a rebuild. And then all of a sudden, he hires a guy that instills a personality that was not there previously onto this roster, and that roster adopts that personality, does not reject it like a faulty organ, and takes it all the way to a division championship, albeit in a truncated season. I think that's the airtight case for that guy to win the GM of the Year award.
I would also throw in there, much like you, and I sort of liken this gentleman to the Kirk Muller to this gentleman's Jacques Martin, I would also throw Gerard Gallant into the great hires there by Mark Bergevin as well, who, as much as you talk about Michel Therrien, much like Kirk Muller was to Jacques Martin, as I'm told, Gerard Gallant is that to Michel Therrien. So another great hire by that general manager. But still, that's just for this year. But how about the idea of creating a team, creating an organization that can withstand significant injury to their number one center and their number one netminder? Creating a structure in the NHL system, in the American Hockey League system as well, with smart drafting, great developing, that you can withstand that type of punishment. You can lose Jason Spezza. You can lose Craig Anderson. To me, you know, the general manager of the year should be, and I'm with you, I think it's a silly award, it should be Brian Murray. And Brian Murray didn't, quote-unquote, do a lot. But A, a couple years ago, he hired the right coach. And B, he's created an environment in Ottawa, both with the Binghamton Senators and the Ottawa Senators, that you can, you know, not just tread water for 10 minutes, but still continue to swim when you lose key pieces. Oh, did I mention they lost Erik Karlsson, too? Well, you've created a system where these players can come up and fill in for large periods of time when your big-name players go down. That, to me, is more astounding, with all due respect, than what Bergevin, Bob Murray, or Ray Shiro did this year.
And also, he won the Heatley trade. I mean, is that the scope of the GM of the Year award? I'm not sure.
Have we judged that yet? Have we finished judging that trade yet?
All right. So you and I agree on GM of the year for the most part of the candidates that are available to be judged. And there you go. Question of the day, of course, is about game sevens. We'll get to that in a second. But I wanted to ask you, sir, about one of these candidates and recent comments that he made about one of his players. Mark Bergevin on PK Subban. He put over PK as a fantastic defenseman, as a Norris caliber candidate, which he, of course, is, but says he's got some ways to go as a player. What are your thoughts on that?
Everybody does. Well, my thoughts on that are pretty simple. You don't want to give Don Meehan, PK Subban's agent, any cannon fodder to throw back at you come negotiating time. So, but on the one hand, he's talking out of one side of his mouth and then talking out the other side of his mouth. I think he deserves a Norris Trophy as best defenseman in the NHL. But I'm certainly not prepared to pay him as if he's a top defenseman in the NHL. Was very guarded with his comments and very political vis-a-vis the agent and the upcoming negotiations between these two sides come negotiating time. It doesn't surprise me. You know, if PK Subban were under contract for, let's say Bergevin got him under contract for 8 years, I think the nature of the comments today would have been much different. He's head and shoulders the best defenseman in this league. He's a combination of grit and toughness and skill and scoring, and he plays heavy minutes in all situations. But there's no way that Mark Bergevin, knowing that he's going to have to pay PK Subban something significant, was going to allow Don Meehan to throw that back into his face. So what you saw was not an authentic comment coming from Mark Bergevin, but rather a political one.
Yeah. Yeah, interesting.
Do you think so? You know, I mean, that's kind of how I read it.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you, and I'm sure that
because
sure
how many times is
misinterpreted in some circles as being abject criticism, but I don't think it's that.
But the thing, how many times do you see like someone's player nominated for a significant award, and the general manager uses it a chance to knock them down? You never do that because Don Meehan's going to walk in there and say, "My client was nominated for," and if he does, and won the Norris Trophy. And, you know, Bergevin wants to make sure that he's already out there out in front saying, you know, he may have been nominated for the Norris Trophy. Let's not get ahead of ourselves here, folks. He still has plenty to learn. When have you ever seen a GM, when one of their players is nominated for award, come out and knock that player? Saying, yeah, but he still has a lot to learn. Never. Never.
The lovely and talented Jeremy Ballaston writes in, might be something to do with Subban's attitude. Who knows what the people in the locker room say.
No, brother. Still?
What? No?
I don't know. I heard all. We knew about all that stuff at the beginning of the season, but I haven't heard anything from about first 2 weeks of the season about it. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure there are some people that don't dig his vibe, but not everybody in every dressing room gets along tiki boo.
I love when you use that phrase, by the way.
Thanks, man. I don't know where I got it.
All right, coming up, Scott Morrison of Sportsnet to talk to us about the Stanley Cup playoffs coming up. Previewing the game sevens tonight between Toronto and Boston and the Rangers and the Capitals, and then also some words for the dearly departed over the weekend. With that, let's start the show proper, shall we?
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
We're going to get corner offices out of this one for sure, Greg. Right away, your BS detector should go off. Why do I know this crap? What's wrong with me? Are you insane?
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
You and I are not quite that dissimilar.
La 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 la, hockey, hockey, hockey.
Seattle is playing excellent defense these days.
What does that even mean?
Debate hockey.
So much junior hockey knowledge in that big juicy brain.
Oh, yeah.
Pop culture.
See, I kind of look at our podcast here like Jazz Odyssey.
There's some bloggers that are great, that are entertaining, that are factual, it's fabulous.
Damn right, JD.
And more hockey.
Just what we need to shoot off the side of the barn. That's how I developed my wrist shot, shooting frozen cow patties in Lloydminster.
Merrick versus Wyshynski.
Merrick versus Wyshynski, huh?
Huh? Yeah. You never get sick of that, do you? That might be your favorite drop from this show. No matter what we do, for however long this show goes, that's going to still be your favorite moment right there. Huh?
Indeed. Question of the day is quite simple. Who has the most to prove tonight and today in tonight's Game 7s? Who has the most to prove in the Game 7s tonight? PuckDaddyBlog at Yahoo.com. At Wyshynski, at Jeff Merrick on Twitter, hashtag at MVSW. And who has the most to prove, Jeff Merrick? Who do you think has the most to prove?
Well, I've got a few candidates. There are two on the Rangers, one on the Caps, a number on the Boston Bruins, And I'll still say one from the Toronto Maple Leafs, and that's Dion Phaneuf. For the Boston Bruins, that entire first line of Patrice Bergeron, although you can call it maybe second line, Patrice Bergeron, Kyler Seguin, and Brad Marchand have been invisible. And when have you ever seen Patrice Bergeron lose as clutch a draw as that from last night? Rangers right. is a pretty easy one. There are two. Rick Nash. Hello, goals. Hello? Any goals? Any goals there? Any goals in there? Brad Richards, who last night played under 10 minutes. Wish Brad Richards under 10 minutes and ended up playing with Kreider and Asham on the fourth line.
Yeah. On the fourth line.
Meet your new line mates, Mr. Richards, multi-million-dollar man. This
and
is
you're
Chris
talking about
Kreider.
A player,
he is a rookie and Aaron Asham.
Dude, that's a player that had no less than, what, seven games in a row with a point to close the season?
Yeah, I know.
I mean, we had somebody on this show or who emailed the show who said they were empty points. And you're starting to see it. And again, now you're starting to see why the talk from earlier this year from guys like Larry Brooks saying they should think about buying out Brad Richards. You're like, what the hell is this guy talking about? But then you're like, oh, wait, he can't skate anymore.
I don't know. I don't know what's gone. I don't know what's happened with Brad Richards. I really don't. I have yeah. no clue. And he's still a big ticket too. 12 last, 12 this year, more to come. What would that buyout be? You know, it's funny. I heard Greg Brady made this point. It's a really good one today on the Brady and Lang show on 590. He said, you know, we all laugh at the Alexei Yashin buyout, but, you know, no one's laughing about this Brad Richards buyout, which would be more significant than the Alexei Yashin buyout were it to happen. And we all ridicule Alexei Yashin in that contract, but where's the ridicule on the Brad Richards contract? There's none.
Yeah. Yeah. That's true.
Who would you go with? Who are your, big guys that got to prove something.
I would go, well, Nash is the obvious one. And you know, the thing about Nash is that, yeah, he's got one point in the series, that it was an assist in game three. Earlier on in the series, not scoring a goal was okay because he was a real catalyst offensively, a difference maker. Now, granted, I think he played a role in the Broussard goal. I think he was sort of a screen on that one. But, shots on goal in the last three games for Rick Nash, 2-2-1 after starting the series, 8-3-4. Needs to be a bit more active with the puck, I think, and peppering Braden Holtby the way he was earlier in the series. So I think for Nash, it's a critical game. Alex Ovechkin, again, it's not a situation where he's been bad, would you say, Merrick? I mean, like, I think he's been active. But the bottom line is that you need goals out of this guy. And the bottom line is that he has won, that he scored in the first game. And it was on the power play. And he doesn't have a point in his last four games. Again, his shots on goal, you know, he got shut down in game four, but game five, 9 shots, game six, 5 shots. He's been very active and he had some great chances against Lundqvist in game six. But you need goals. You need to get goals. And the idea that this guy scored, roughly a gajillion times down the stretch and has one goal in this series is a little disconcerting. Yeah. Bruins,
yeah,
I agree.
It... Okay.
What? No, go ahead.
No,
what
I was going to say, I was going to ask you about the Rangers and the Washington Capitals. By the way, again, another example of a very exciting 1-0 game last night. Would you call it, and it's a horrible cliche, but you got to spit it out there, I suppose. Is this statement game night? Like, is this a chance where if you're a big game player, just from an individual point of view, not team, if you're an individual player, like, is this not why you got Rick Nash? Is this not why you got Brad Richards?
Well, in the case of Richards, I mean, it is what it is. I don't quite know what's going on there. But in the case of Nash, this is the sole reason why he's a Ranger, is to score in a game like this, is to give them the goal they don't get in games like this. And it's got to happen.
Here's the weird thing about it. So they trade Rick Nash and got rid of a lot of their depth. And then they had to trade Marian Gaborik to get that depth back. So where are they? Like, you really could make the argument that, you know, in the last 12 months, they've just kind of stayed in the same place. When you break
could
it
be.
Down, right?
Could be. Although that Gaborik trade is looking pretty good, though, as far as the return.
Derek Dorsett. Or not Derek Dorsett. Derek Brassard.
No, you could say Derek Dorsett. Dorsett's turned into
and
Chris
Dorsett
Neal for
too,
them.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
They needed that element, and he's provided it. I mean, watching him in his first game with the Rangers in this series, he had the same Sean Avery-esque, I'm going to do something positive and then do something crushingly dumb to undercut it. But at the same time, though, my play is going to be a distraction. You're going to notice me on every shift. And that was something the Rangers didn't have in their lineup. The Bruins, I mean, the guy, Sagan is inexplicably bad, but he's got 27 shots on goal. Donde es Brad Marchand? Now, Marchand's a guy who, after the cup run, was being seen as a player who elevates his game in the postseason. And now he's not done that now for consecutive postseasons. Two assists in the series, no goals. You got to get goals out of this guy. And for me, to not have him score after 18 in the regular season has been as much a story as Sagan, but Sagan obviously gets the press because of the whole Phil Kessel angle. For the Maple Leafs, anybody on the Leafs that has pressure, Merrick?
Dion Phaneuf, I still think, has to.
You think so?
I don't think that one game is like, oh, okay, he's absolved. Everything is fine now.
You could say Grabowski has pressure because he's -7 with an assist and not been good at all.
But at least you can see that he's trying to create. Like, some guys just going through the motions, okay, this is my position, this is how I'm going to play, so I can go back to the bench and say, well, I did everything that I was told to do. At least you can tell that Grabowski is trying to create something.
Can you say the same with Kulman?
Doesn't always work.
Because Kulman's also -7 with one assist.
I know. It's so weird, eh, too? I mean, that big body can really move his feet, too. I can't figure out what's going on. I mean, he had a hard time after Igor Korolev passed away. Those two were very close, but here we are a year out now, more than a year out, and he's still... struggling.
The obvious answer is that Brian Burke is right, and this should be a roster populated by Americans. These foreigners are undercutting the entire campaign for the Leafs, and clearly need to not be on the team. No pressure on Reimer, no pressure on Van Riemsdyk, no pressure on Kessel, even though, again, this could be a scoreboard moment for Kessel to win a Game 7 in Boston with a goal of some sort. And then never have to hear grief from the Bruins fans again. But this is borrowed time for the Leafs. It really is. And kudos to James Reimer for putting together back-to-back games of brilliance to get this team to a Game 7.
Ever since he showed his wife on Hockey Night in Canada, they've attached a rocket to that team's back, and they have not looked back. Scott Morrison is joining us now from Sportsnet, also winner of the 2006 Elmer Ferguson Memorial Award. Scotty, how are you today, sir?
I'm doing well, boys. How are you?
Doing well.
Good. Before we get to the Maple Leafs and the Bruins, something Greg and I were batting around a couple of seconds ago. The likely candidates are Brad Richards and Rick Nash and Alexander Ovechkin, Dion Phaneuf, the entire line of Tyler Seguin, Brad Marchand, and Patrice Bergeron. Which player tonight, Scott, do you think has the most to prove out of anyone in both Game 7s?
Well, I think certainly in that Washington Rangers series, I mean, Ovechkin and Nash have to be the guys. It's kind of one of those defining moments to get a team over the hump. And, you know, the Rangers obviously went to great expense and to bring in Nash to be a difference maker for them. And, and Ovechkin has to prove that he's a guy that can take a team on his back and get them along too. And he's been a little bit cold points wise in the last few games and they've struggled as a result. So I would look at those two guys as, having the most to prove, certainly in that series.
It's interesting to look at the coaches in that series too, Scott. You look at the fact that you've got a first year guy in Adam Oates, who, you know, was maligned at the beginning of the season because the team wasn't off to a great start, but I think his stock has certainly risen in the eyes of a lot of people. Versus John Tortorella, who, you know, got his team to the conference final last year, but now could be looking at another first-round exit. The pressure on Torts, and do you ever think that this guy's in the hot seat, or is he Teflon in that city?
I don't know that I would call him Teflon. I think if they bow out, there's a lot of people going to look and say, you know, that was a... not a great season for them, finishing in the seven hole, and then falling to Washington in the first round, seven games. They won it in seven last year, of course, but I think there would be a review. I just wonder again, given that it's a shortened season and all the rest, if that doesn't buy some coaches a break when it comes to assessment time, and you still have to answer the question: are you a coaching change away from being a better team, or were there some personnel decisions and the composition of the team, was that the issue? And I think you could argue by how they reacted at the trade deadline that they weren't entirely comfortable with the composition of that roster.
No, we're just making the point a second ago, Scott, that when you look at the trade, the Marian Gaborik trade, it was almost as if they got Rick Nash from Columbus, but traded with, you know, Dubinsky and Anisimov. They traded a lot of their depth that really helps come stretch drive and come playoff time as well. And then had to go back and get that depth from the Columbus Blue Jackets, but it cost them Marian Gaborik. So what have they really done over the past 12 months?
Well, exactly. So it's they needed to get a little bit grittier because they lost a little bit of that in the off season. So, you know, and the other question they ask is, you know, what's happened with a Brad Richards? All of a sudden, he's playing on your fourth line, and you know, based on how he's played, it makes sense. But can you imagine saying that coming into a season?
Yeah, no, exactly. I couldn't imagine seeing him skate with Chris Kreider and Aaron Asham last night and playing under 10 minutes, Scott. That, to me, was shocking.
Yeah, him and Nash were just a point each in this series. So there's been some underperforming there. There's no question.
Now, I'm no conspiracy theorist, but I do find it strange to see a Game 6 in which the best power play team in all of hockey doesn't get a single power play against the Rangers. Do you find that as inexplicable as I do, Scott?
Well, and they don't win when they don't get a power play goal or two or three, and obviously no opportunity for it yesterday. So I didn't see we were down at Maple Leaf Square, so I didn't really get a good look at that game. So I can't say that the Zebras were working the game to make sure there was a Game 7.
Hey, you know, let's get to Maple Leaf Square, that Maple Leaf Boston Bruins series, Scott. The Maple Leaf Square phenomena is, you know, not new around the NHL, but certainly new to Toronto. How do you feel that Leafs fans are not behaving, but how do you feel that Leafs fans are sort of greeting it? Because it's very bizarre.
What are you tap dancing around here? What are you trying to say? Just say it.
Here's what I'm trying to say. It's almost as if Leafs fans have said to themselves, we can really do this? Like, it's just a foreign concept. Like, we can all get together in this big place outside the Air Canada Center where there's actually playoff hockey happening inside that building. Are fans there, you know, are they enjoying themselves, or do you think they're a little bit surprised that they're there in the first place?
Well, that space didn't exist the last time they were in the playoffs. Therefore, it is a new phenomenon 9 years later. But, you know, the crowds have been ridiculously large down there. They just totally filled the space, and by and large have been very well behaved, and win or lose. And so I think they're having a good time. They stood out there on, what was it, Friday night in the pouring rain, and then I can assure you that last night was less than comfortable from a temperature standpoint, and they hung in there, and a huge roar when that game ended. And so I think they're really enjoying the ride, and it's Toronto like we don't necessarily see it very often, with people letting their hair down, having some fun, my God, drinking a beer outside, and behaving themselves while they do it. So just a lot of people really enjoying this experience. So good on them. I heard they sold something like $45,000-$50,000 worth of beer the other night. So there you go. Of course, it's $10 a tin. It's not hard to get there.
Hey, let me ask you about Phil Kessel. Where were you at the beginning of the series on Kessel? Did you think that there was some voodoo hex, and by that I mean the unholy trinity of Tuukka Rask, Zdeno Chara, and Patrice Bergeron, that would keep this guy in check the entire way? Or were you confident that Kessel was not the complete zilch that he seemed to be against the Bruins?
Yeah, I wasn't entirely confident, that's for sure, but I've been impressed with how he's stuck his nose in there, and he's played hard. He still gets a lot of shots from the periphery, but you know, a lot of that speaks to just how he plays. But he's been not afraid to get in there and rub noses, or at least get in and bump alongside and take a punishment from Chara when they were matching up, especially early in the season. And you know, he's used his great wheels at times, and he scored a couple of or three goals in the series now, which is a huge monkey off his back when you look at the stats that he had in, what, 22 games against the Bruins since the deal. So, you know, I think he's done a lot of good things, and I think he's shown that he can rise to the occasion and be a difference maker. So, you know, I think he's been pretty darn good for them.
And now, Scott, with the performance of James Reimer, does this now finally cement that the Leafs are out of looking for another goaltender, be it, you know, they chased Kiprusoff before, the Luongo rumors are still out there. Has that all been put to bed, you think?
Well, until he gives up a bad goal, and then it'll start all over again. You know what the goaltending conversations are like, it seems, in certain Canadian cities. But, I mean, the one thing, I think you can look at this and say that this kid has taken his game up a notch. I mean, he showed unbelievable character throughout the season. I mean, he doesn't even start the season. He's not declared the number one guy coming into it. He earns that spot, and yet at the trade deadline, he's still sitting and listening to the talk of the Leafs kicking tires in Calgary and kicking tires. Well, did they make the call to Vancouver? Did Vancouver make the call to them? There's, I guess, a subtle difference there. But again, not knowing knowing what was going to happen when the dust settled at 3 Eastern after that deadline day, and then played his best hockey of the season after that, and then he comes in without experience into the playoffs and has been really, really good. I mean, and gotten better as the series has gone along and been arguably their best player in the last two games. Certainly back in Game 5, I thought he was had to make more good saves than he did in Game 6, but he was rock solid in both. So he's shown an unbelievable character and toughness, the ability to bounce back after a bad goal or a bad, or an off game, if you will. And I think they can look at him as being that number one guy, and now maybe you make the focus in the off season of finding a second guy who maybe has a little more experience and can fit into that role of not playing every other night and, you know, just being a guy that spells him off.
Last one for me. I had to make a hasty pick in the Western Conference semifinals through a Yahoo video, and I found myself succumbing to something I didn't want to succumb to, which is the siren song of the San Jose Sharks. I feel like they're different. I feel like there's some different dynamic to them. I don't know if it's the Larry Robinson effect or it being the team of Couture and Pavelski instead of the team of Marlowe and Thornton. Whatever it is, I picked them in 7, and I just need you to tell me whether or not that's stupid.
I haven't gotten around to my head wrapped around the picture. I don't think it's a bad pick at all, and I had them winning in the first round. And, you know, the one thing is their best player all year has been the goalie. And, you know, he's proven that he can step it up in playoff time, Niemi. And, you know, during a stretch, and they were such a streaky team during the season. They win 7 to come out of the gate, and then they flatline for a while, couldn't score any goals, and then come back and get strong again. And, you know, when they were battling just to get into the playoffs, and then, you know, had a really good series. So I think, you know, I like the way Thornton's played. I think he's dispelled any rumors that he doesn't show up in the springtime. Marlowe had a terrific series. Couture is really, I think it's his team now. I mean, Jumbo hasn't let him go entirely, but Couture is that next, you know, the next wave that's taking over, and Pavelski playing exceptionally well too. So, you know, I wouldn't bet against them. I think they're going to make it a real tough series.
And one series, Scott, I'll end on this one, that begins tomorrow, which probably features the most interesting handshake alley of any two opponents in the National Hockey League, that being Pittsburgh and the Ottawa Senators, for the obvious Matt Cook, Eric Karlsson reasons. Your thoughts on this series?
Yeah, kind of some interesting storylines there, to say the least. And, you know, on the Ottawa side, it's just, I mean, you just keep thinking that, you know, how do these guys get it done? And obviously the goaltending has been, of Craig Anderson, has just been absolutely brilliant. Getting Karlsson back was a huge, you know, you talk about deadline acquisitions. Well, how do you get any better than getting a guy like that back in your lineup? And it's just been a team that's been so resilient all season and finding ways to win and finding ways to get it done despite all the adversity they've had to deal with. And then on the flip side, you look at that Pittsburgh team and the nice additions they made at the trade deadline, and most seemed to be working out for them, and yet had a kind of an awkward, uncomfortable first series with the Islanders. And now who starts in goal? Is it Bocoon's to lose? Is it Bocoon to carry the rest of the way? What happens with Fleury and that whole back end? I mean, they gave up when they were struggling, and they gave up goals, and that has to be a concern for them. But I'm just not sure that Ottawa has the firepower to quite the way that the Islanders possessed with Tavares and company, but they're not going to give up a lot either, so there's going to be pressure on the Penguins in that regard. So I think it has the potential to be a fascinating series, and mostly because Ottawa's just that team that won't go away. And then, of course, we're going to have CSI Ottawa following Matt Cook around for the entire series, so that's the other compelling storyline. Eugene Melnyk with his sunglasses on following him around. So.
Well told, Scott. Well told. All right, Scotty, thanks so much for stopping by. I know you got to get some business to take care of, so we appreciate your time, sir, and we will see you around the shop sooner than later.
Yeah, you will indeed, and enjoy the Game 7s tonight, and even one in junior hockey to make it a trio. So it's going to be a fun night.
That's right. Little London and Barrie action. Thank you, Scott Morrison, for a little plug for CHL. There, we did the We did game five on Friday, Greg. Big win for the London Knights. 14 game six. They win game six in Barrie. Goes to overtime on a gorgeous pass by Max Domi, who really has played spectacular in these playoffs.
Absolutely.
And then game seven is tonight. So Portland is through. Saskatoon is hosting. Halifax is through. We'll find out tonight whether it's London or Barrie as the fourth member of the teams competing for the Memorial Cup. So big one. It's my favorite tournament, eh? It's my favorite tournament.
Me too. Me too. It's nice that Scott Niedermeyer doesn't have a kid around Max Domi's age, so he won't get bonged.
But hold on a second. Ulf Samuelsson does, and they played against each other the Mora Cup last year. Henrik Samuelsson's Edmonton Oil Kings played against Max Domi's London Knights without incident.
Feel like an effing fossil.
Oh, yeah. Oh, dude, trust me. I go to my first Oshawa Generals game of the year, and what was it, October this year? And who's the first player I see? Andrew Castle's son. Okay, I feel pretty old, because I'm thinking like, oh yeah, Andrew Castle, he's not that old. I just saw him like play yesterday. Yeah, not so much. It's kids playing in the OHL. Every time I see that.
What's his son's name?
I'll get his stats for you here too.
If it's not Sand, he's doing it wrong. If he has a daughter and it's not Crystal, he's doing it wrong. Sand. Blessed
what's
last
that?
Name of Castles. You gotta go either Sand Castles or Crystal Castles.
No,
Cole Castles. Cole Castles?
Cole Castles, yeah.
Man.
Who was born in Columbus, by the way, when he played there. Andrew Castles played there.
Not bad.
He's American.
American. Hey, we should probably talk about the Penguins and the Islanders over the weekend. You know, a bunch of series, obviously, went final over the weekend. Vokoun comes in, wins two straight. Obviously, you go with him in game one of the following series with an eye towards reestablishing Fleury if Vokoun falters. Yes, or do you come back with Fleury in game one?
No, I think you go with Vokoun. I think you have to. Otherwise, how awkward is that conversation? How horrible is that conversation? You know, you've just gone 2-0. You totally saved our bacon. We could have bowed out against the New York Islanders, an 8-1. But you know what? You're going to sit on the bench because we got to rehabilitate this guy. We got to get this guy's confidence back up. So thanks, Thomas. No way. I think you go right back in there with Thomas Vokoun.
Yeah, and the thing about it is that, like, I understand there being reservations if this was a true backup taking over the starter situation. But honestly, like, I feel like that was last year, and I feel like that if you acquire a former starter like Vokoun, knowing what happened to Fleury in the playoffs last year, you're acknowledging the fact that the torch could be passed at some point.
Could happen.
Yeah.
Yep. This could happen. Sure. That's exactly. And even, I mean, didn't Dan Bylsma actually just say it? This is why we got him.
Yeah.
This is why we went out and got Thomas Vokoun in case of this scenario.
Exactly. All right. Looking at the rest of the series over the weekend, the Kings eliminate the Blues in six games. Yeah, I know.
I wanted seven. I actually wanted that to be the conference. The way that it was played, I wanted that to be the conference final. I really did.
It was a terrific series, but you have to admit there was a certain downy softness to the way that Brian Elliott was playing goal towards the end of that series.
Towards the end of it, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But also, you've been saying this on the show for a couple of days now, but it really is the Drew Doughty of last playoff run right now. He is playing out of his mind.
And part of it, too, is, you know, that having Robin Regier as his defense partner, his main defense partner, that just opens him up to freestyle. And haven't you always got the impression that he's going to do better when he's able to freestyle all over the ice when he has someone in his own zone who's going to stay there and say, you know what, go do your thing. I got this back here. Much like they had been playing with Willie Mitchell, you know, when Willie Mitchell was healthy. Don't worry, Drew, go out and do your thing. I'm back here. We're fine. And he's found that again with Robin Regier. Like, the minute they made that trade, the first person that got that improved was Drew Doughty.
Yeah.
You kind of feel that way?
I do, in fact. And it's the same thing as Pietrangelo in getting Bomeister. You know, explicitly a pickup to help your best defenseman become even better. All right, Wings and Ducks last night. And here's the problem whenever you draw the Red Wings in the first round, is that even when they don't have Nick Lidstrom, and even when they don't have Brad Stewart, and even when they have a young and in some ways patchwork defense, and they're basically a one-line team, they can still lock your ass down, which is what happened last night. The Ducks could not establish anything in the offensive zone for most of that game, and it was vintage Mike Babcock hockey. Possession, setting the tempo, allowing Datsyuk and Zetterberg to really get their chances in the offensive zone, and then and then watch them get back and spoil chances the other way. It was vintage Red Wings, and they can still do that to you, and they did it to the Ducks last night.
And the pairing of Cronwall and Erickson was the best in that series.
Yeah.
Hands down, the best in that series. And doesn't Abdelkader look nice up on that first line with 40 and 13?
Flying around.
Like a really nice, yeah, great speed. Because let's face it, this Detroit Red Wings team, outside of Darren Helm and Justin Abdelkader, aren't exactly known for their speed. A lot is made of that third line for good reason, Nyquist, Anderson, and Damian Bruner, but you're getting contributions from everywhere. Again, how long have you been waiting for Valtteri Filppula to really bust open? And every now and then you get the glimpses. Last night was a glimpse, playing with Franzen and Dan Cleary. Last night was one of those glimpses. It's a frustrating hockey player. And as we've talked about before, he's going to be looking for $5 million this offseason. Not sure he finds that, but if it's the player we saw last night, then he's worth every penny of that $5 million. So there's still, you're right, in an opening round series, I don't think they have the horses to do much damage. Well, I'm going to run into this wall of the Chicago Blackhawks now, but for an opening round, it's a bad opponent for anyone to have. To say nothing of Jimmy Howard, who really played well.
How many games do you give him against the Blackhawks, by the way?
Oh, man, my predictions are awful. 5 or 6. I think they win 1, maybe 2. Don't forget, Dave Bolin's healthy. Bolin's back. He's playing on the second line there today.
I think it can go 6. I think Howard steals a game. Maybe they get a game with the Joe as well. They've lost 7 straight in various ways to the Blackhawks.
How do you read the opening round against the Minnesota Wild, knowing that sure they won, they're gonna win. You're just gonna beat the Minnesota Wild, but that they didn't play good hockey. Is that, and that was Joe Quenneville's words as well, is that an indication that this team is slumping, or is it scary because this team didn't even come close to hitting on all cylinders and still took out the Minnesota Wild in 5?
I'm going to go with column B. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Wild pushed them a bit, but I never felt like they were threatened. I felt like the Penguins were threatened in that series.
Yep, me too.
Against the Islanders.
Yep, me too. That was a great game on Saturday, eh? That was a lot of fun. That was a fun game. That was a really fun game to watch.
Yep. You know, and you know, it's one of those situations as a fan of a rival team that you acknowledge the fact that what the Islanders did was wonderful, but you hate the... Here's what I hate as a Devils fan, and I think this is where Red Wings fans and Devils fans have a certain kinship. The bar is so high for your team that you never get a year like the Islanders had. You never get a year of patting you on the head like a puppy who just learned how to not mess the house. You know what I mean? Like, it's no matter what the Islanders did in this series, it was a mulligan. It was like, good for you. Hockey's back at NASA. Hooray, Islanders. If the Devils go out and won, it's like, another wasted season of Marty Brodeur's career. You know, it's just like we'd have to lose for the next 7 years to get back to that point, to hit the reset button, to expunge all of the history and all of the expected success of this franchise, to get back to where the Islanders are now. But like, it's those moments of attaboy, good job on you, Islanders. They lost in 6. You know what I mean? They had their chances and they lost in 6.
Everyone loves John Tavares, right? Safe to say, and I think everyone has now become a lot more appreciative of the work of Travis Hamonic.
And also Kyle Okposo.
Kyle Okposo as well. But for me, did Matt Martin pop out to you? Of all players?
Because
every
such
time I saw
asset.
Matt Martin.
Yep.
Every time I saw him, he was doing something.
But dude, I tried to tell you all about Nabokov before the series. You wouldn't listen. This is the shit he does. He gives you everything you need for a couple games. Then he has that game where it's like, whoops, I let in one I shouldn't have let in. And then he has that game where it's like, oh, that wasn't all that good, was it? And it's the same thing Sharks fans have seen for a decade. And any Sharks fan that watched that game 6 said to themselves, yep, that's exactly how it's supposed to end for the Islanders because Nabokov's their goalie.
He's the one starting netminder of recent memory where all we...
Oh, I think Merrick disappeared. He needs to come back. Where did he go? We'll find out his Nabokov thing in one moment, but I wanted to actually jump back...
With a discussion about his...
Oh, there he is.
Was that?
Hey, you dropped out, by the way.
Oh, did I? Okay, so the point that I was making about Yevgeny Nabokov, do you find it interesting that when you look, when you ever have a conversation with Yevgeny Nabokov, all we ever do is talk about his losses? We never talk about a win that he's had. It's always about a loss or a combination of losses. Like, he's the one goaltender of recent note in the last 10 years that nature of the conversation is always about one specific thing, the game that he lost.
Which is, again, amazing when you consider he's the second most winning goaltender behind Brodeur for that stretch.
Is that right? Well, volume of games, right? Volume of games, and San Jose was always a competitive team. Wow.
It's pretty crazy, right?
Jeez.
That's crazy. I wanted to jump back to the Ducks series real quick because we didn't talk about one guy. So as much as Sagan is getting shit on and Rick Nash is getting shit on for their performances in the East, Corey Perry didn't score a goal in seven games against Detroit. You have to go back to 2005-2006 when he was 20 years old and a rookie for the Mighty Ducks of Anaheim, the last time Corey Perry appeared in a playoff series and didn't score a goal. Hell, in 2007-2008, he played in three games and scored two goals. No goals in seven games against a team you have to score against if you're one of the star players for the Anaheim Ducks. Has to happen. So no Corey Perry. What are you going to do? Getzlaff got his assist. That was nice in game seven, but no Corey Perry, the goalless. After signing that big ass contract and no good in that series at all. Looking forward to the game sevens of America. Dropped off for a second. Looking forward to the game sevens tonight. You know, the Rangers victory, like I mentioned, the Scott Morrison was an interesting one because, again, inexplicable that the Washington Capitals don't get a power play. There are opportunities for the Rangers to be whistled for a minor that was not a matching minor. It didn't happen. It's just weirdness to see a game in which one team so proficient on the power play doesn't get one, and it kind of raises your radar a little bit. But I'm not saying the fix is in or nothing like that. But it is what it is. Lundqvist brilliant in that game. They're going to need him to be brilliant again. Ovechkin obviously had his chances. You watch the highlights. He had at least four or five chances that were golden opportunities to score on Lundqvist, but couldn't convert. Broussard, the goal. Broussard's been the MVP offensively for them in this series, but nothing out of Richards and nothing out of Nash. And that has to change in game seven. Game seven is a chamber of horrors for the Washington Capitals. It is. They've lost a good number of game sevens on home ice. It's not necessarily where they want to be in this series. I will say this. I think it's a different vibe in this series where the Capitals are very confident that they can hold home ice against this Rangers team. And really, the pressure is on the Rangers. The margin of error in this series is so slim for the Rangers where if they give up a power play goal to the Capitals, they could be cooked. If they get down early, they could be cooked. I mean, the Rangers offense simply is not there where they can keep pace with this Capitals team if they get too many opportunities. And,
hello.
Hey, how you doing?
Yeah, sorry about that. Dropped out.
That's right.
Had to reconnect. Got my 26-4 back.
That's fine. And so I was just saying about the Rangers and the Caps and the fact that the Rangers cannot allow the Capitals to get on them early with a goal.
No, and this is the Homer series too, right? Where's all the pressure on this one, you think? To me, it's all in the Caps.
You think the pressure's all in the Caps?
Yeah.
Really? That's a
Homer series. Got to win this one at home.
I get that, but new coach, and a team that was moribund until Ovechkin and Backstrom caught fire and bought them back. You think the pressure's on the Caps? Even though the Rangers were a conference finalist last year?
Yeah, pressure. Yeah, I really do because it's this year. Just you know, it feels like everybody just sort of washed everything away from last season. It's a shortened season, a truncated season, whatever. And yeah, the fact that you're going into tonight's game and you have Henrik Lundqvist and those MVP chants last night from MSG still ringing in your ears if you're a member of the Capitals. Don't you think?
Yeah.
Like all of a sudden, like now this guy's back, like really back. And he was phenomenal last night. I don't know. I'm still thinking I know it's on their ice, but have you found that this year, more than any other year in the playoffs, teams are playing tighter at home than they're playing on the road? It should be the opposite. It should be completely the opposite. And you're seeing this in the Boston-Toronto series too. But teams at home this year maybe I'm projecting, but it just seems as if teams at home this year are playing tighter than they ever have. And I don't know why that is.
Yeah. I know. That's because the stakes are so high. You know why,
and you
Merrick?
You know why?
Because it's the cup is the reason why.
You know why? Stakes are so high because everyone thinks they have a shot. Everyone really thinks they have a chance. Like, there's no situation where, oh, we're just happy to be here. Oh, yeah, we're just glad. Maybe you saw that with the Minnesota-Chicago series. But did you ever get a sense of in any of the playoff matchups in the first round that anyone thought that they were just, well, happy to be a passenger? No. Like, yeah, I got the sense that every team legitimately believed they could win this series. I think that's where the tension comes from in this opening round. There's no teams that are just getting there to roll over and say, all right, take four and get out of here.
Indeed.
And maybe you're going to get more of that, right? I mean, we keep talking about going back to 05, you know, the salary cap and the parity, and all teams feel they have a shot. Maybe that's just the way it's going to be from now on in the NHL. And if that's true, then good, because it's making some pretty good hockey.
It's been making great hockey.
Hmm.
I agree. You wouldn't go as far as great?
No, I won't, because the salary cap does not produce greatness. It produces goodness.
Mediocrity, average teams, but great could produce great hockey. No.
Yeah. I still see too much. I'm going to nitpick, and everyone gets on me when I nitpick the game right now because it's so great, it's so awesome, it's so fantastic.
Yeah, conform. You can just conform finally.
No, sorry, I can't. I just don't see enough east-west play. I see a lot of north-south. Go to the net, throw it in front of the net, and then everyone just jam at it and poke at it. Hey, look, we scored a goal. Jam, jam, jam. Poke, 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 poke. Yeah. Okay, I guess. I kind of like the plays. I don't know. How many? We all marvel now when we see a team pull off like three passes in a row in the offensive zone. It's like, wow, look at them move the puck. It's because now no one moves the puck. You just get it on net and you fill the net. Like you watch the Pittsburgh Penguins, like, you know, Malkin over to Neal, back to Malkin. Look at that passing play. He scores. We marvel at it. That should kind of be the norm. That's like playing. But then we go back to the game being overcoached. I think that's a bigger problem. And again, the point that I'll make that I was talking about last week with Jágr. The game has never featured more highly skilled players, but on the other hand, this game now does not allow those players to highlight their entire skill set because it's so formulaic and so systems-oriented.
Here's what I'm excited about, the fact that Josh has a new drop-in for the next intro, with you going jam, 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 poke, poke, poke. I'm very excited.
Yeah.
I'm very
excited. Had a good
excited.
Weekend, bro. Had a good
Josh
weekend.
Josh is
going to
work
yeah.
that into the fray.
good.
Hey, before we get to the question today, I wanted to ask you about a story that broke late Sunday. It is an off the ice story. It involves Derek Boogaard and his family.
Yeah.
The late Derek Boogaard. Now, this, you know, they sued the NHLPA many moons ago, but that was sort of a procedural thing and got thrown out. This is the one we've been waiting on, which is a direct wrongful death lawsuit against the National Hockey League. Not only for its doctors plying Boogaard allegedly with copious amounts of pills, but more to the point, not treating his concussions properly, sending him back out on the ice without regard to his concussions, not properly rehabbing him when it became apparent that he had addictions to painkillers and such. All of these things combined, if you look at what the lawsuit is, Merrick, it appears to be the first NFL-style lawsuit attacking
Bingo.
The NHL, not only for a concussion protocol, not only for its drug policies as far as what to give players to get over the pain, but also kind of Boogaard was an enforcer and was told to do these things to the detriment of his health.
Yeah, see, that's a tough one because I don't know that anyone's – I mean, when you get to the NHL, I mean, you get there having already done that. It's not as if, you know, the Rangers are going to turn to Chris Kreider and say, okay, now all of a sudden you're going to have 20 fights on your dance card. You
right.
get there because that's what you've done. No one's turned into a fighter by a coach in the NHL. You are hired as a fighter by the NHL. By the time you get there, everybody kind of knows the score.
Yeah, you're turned into
so
a
that's
fighter
where the law,
down the line. Like, you know, in the AHL or at some point in the sticks, you're turned into a fighter. But not when you get to the league. Reason you're called up is because you're a fighter.
You know, the great example I always give is someone like Chris Bartsch, who when he played with the London Knights of the OHL was a scorer. He was a scoring player who I don't think ever put up more than maybe 60, 70 penalty minutes a season, but then realize if I'm going to have any living in this game, I'm going to have to do something different because my skill set may be good for junior, but it won't translate to the NHL. So it's a guy that got the job in the East Coast Hockey League and started fighting and started learning how to do that. and that became his on-ramp into the NHL. But no one becomes a fighter in the NHL. You're hired as a fighter in the NHL. So that one always comes up a little shallow for me. Oh, he was forced to do these things he didn't want to do. That's poppycock. That's why he was hired. But he was drafted, and that's why he was, you know, traded. Now, you know, that's why he was signed. Like, that happens.
I'm no lawyer, obviously. But I wonder whether or not the fact that we've learned so much more about concussions and CTE and head injuries over the course of even the last 5 years could weigh in the favor of a league like the National Hockey League. Because, yeah, you could take them to task for maybe being a little bit hands-off and a little bit old school with head injuries in the past. But the bottom line is that they've definitely made the effort. And then you could question how far the effort's gone. But when you get things like Rule 48, when you get things like the concussion protocol, quiet room, such as it is, all these other things, I mean, at least there is the appearance of an effort made to address head injuries for players. The question is, yeah, too little, too late? Or is it just the NHL progressing along with medical science when it comes to the concussion crisis in professional sports?
The key to all of it is going to be, you know, did they have knowledge that they were putting Derek Boogaard in a dangerous situation? And did they, you know, ignore what Derek Boogaard was going through, even though they put him through rehab a number of different times, correct?
Right.
Like, it wasn't as if he wasn't getting help and he was getting ignored and just getting, you know, pumped up full of, you know, whatever, Bob Geldof in Pink Floyd's The Wall. Get out there on stage. You know, just get out there and perform. I don't think it was like that. Having said that, again, like you, I'm not a lawyer, and this case is a lot more subtle and nuanced than I'm, you know, you and I are both portraying it. But at the same time, to me it comes down, I'm glad you brought up the NFL analogy, because this is their first NFL test. To me it comes down, Phil, to, you know, were they willfully negligent? Did they know he was like this and still chose to do nothing? Because if you look at the evidence, I mean, weren't they, everyone, whether it was the NHL, whether it was the club teams, weren't they going out of their way to make sure this guy got treatment and this guy got help?
Yeah. It's going to be an interesting case. I mean, I still think not as fascinating as the Bertuzzi case, but a fascinating case nonetheless. The other thing we should talk about before we get to the question of the day, your good friend Mike Keenan getting a new job, is he?
Yeah. Yeah, new head coach of Metallurg Magnitogorsk, a team once coached by Dave King. By the way, if you're, I always get requests about hockey books, Dave King's King of Russia is a fascinating one. It's about his time coaching Magnitogorsk. Evgeny Malkin was on that team then, by the way. That's a great read. It's called King of Russia, written by former NHL coach and former Team Canada national coach Dave King. Paul Maurice coached there last year. And now next year, I believe he signed a 2-year contract, I think, Wish. I was texting with him this morning. Mike Keenan will be the new head coach of Metallurg Magnitogorsk. And by the way, I just texted with him right before the show, because I wanted to know which rink he was at to shoot that promo, that awesome WWE-style promo that Mike Keenan, it's not even WWE, it's like old-school territory days, that old-school promo that Keenan shot. That's at Magnitogorsk Arena, by the way, just so we're on the same page. But, yeah. Iron Mike taking his vocal and coaching stylings to the KHL. I have no idea how this is going to work out. But I know that Mike's been itching to coach again.
We'll see. As I said on the blog, I can't wait for them to hire the translator that's going to have to relay all of Mike's candid thoughts to the Russian players in their native tongue.
Mike's a really upfront guy. As many people who...
Oh, yeah.
And I just know that from working with him for a couple of years at Sportsnet. He was never my coach. Remember, I used to skate with the late Peter Zezla all the time, and Zez loved him. Zez would always go on with great stories about Mike Keenan. It's the one thing he said, you always knew where you stood with Mike Keenan. 100%. Isn't that what players have always asked for? Just tell me where I stand. Don't BS around anything. That's what you're going to get with Keenan. For sure. And I like that. I mean, the thing about Keenan that I like, too, and this plays a lot more on the KHL these days than ever before. You know, Mike don't mind when it gets a little rough. Mike kind of likes that.
Mike, he likes it rough, huh?
Mike, he does.
He seems the type. All right, question of the day. Who feels the most pressure tonight in the Game 7s? Kevin Gazzelli writes in, Tyler Seguin, 0 points. And looking at just the series, the Kessel trade looks like a great deal for the Leafs' random penguin. David Capuano, Jack Capuano's brother.
Very hip. You know what? It's funny. We go back to our conversation about GM of the year. Are we even close to judging that trade? Because right now, the Maple Leafs have won that trade hands down. They really have. But
the Kessel trade.
Yeah.
I could not disagree with you more.
That the Maple Leafs have won that trade?
They did not win that
trade. Right now?
Right now
they have.
No.
Right now they have, yeah.
They have not.
Explain.
Because I think the two players that the Bruins have the potential to be exponentially better than Phil Kessel.
The potential. But there are two things. There's actual and there's potential.
Right.
And the actual player that Phil Kessel is right now is better than the actual that is Tyler Seguin and Dougie Hamilton.
Well, then
I'm not saying
Ray,
5 years
well,
down,
no, you're
I'm not saying 5 years down the road.
Give Ray Shiro, GM of the century. He made a bunch of trades that don't affect the Penguins in any way, shape, or form.
Good move.
As far as their future.
That's what I'm saying. Like right now, at this moment, the Maple Leafs have won that trade. But history may judge that completely differently. If Tyler Seguin turns into the player we think he can be, and ditto for Dougie Hamilton. But right now, Dougie Hamilton's a rookie that was scratched a bunch and can't get into the playoffs outside of a couple of games when players are injured. And Tyler Seguin has gone silent for the Boston Bruins.
Phil
Kessel hasn't.
My problem with your Seguin analysis is that you completely forget about the fact he was a goal-per-game player in Switzerland.
That is a good point. And Phil Kessel, as we've seen, by turning down Team USA for the World Hockey Championships previously, right, has no desire to play anywhere except the NHL.
He's completely selfish. Juan David Elavenda. Evelendendia. Yes. Question today. Everyone on the Bruins, whatever happened to Don't Poke the Bear? Also, if Boston loses, let's see here. Oh, forget it. And good luck with your last name. Thank you. I was terrible with your last name. Let's see here. Question of the day. Paul Benita. Easily has to be Rick Nash, Brad Richards. These two dudes have the Joe Thornton, Patrick Marleau stigma on them right now. Random Penguin in Wyshynski Pierre voice. Sidney, the greatest player in the world, Crosby.
These RPs are getting pretty creative. It keeps coming back to Nash, eh?
It does.
Keeps coming back to Rick Nash. That's the one where I wonder, you know, if the Rangers go out tonight, you know, how much is Rick Nash going to hear it going forward for being, you know, just a great regular season player that again, but it's only his second shot at the playoffs.
Alvin Bawa writes in, Brad Richards, before Nash, Richards was bought on to be a playoff leader. He set his own standard before, see Tampa Bay's Cup run, Dallas's runs in 09 and 10. But as a Ranger, he's yet to be a hero, let alone a playoff leader. And with whispers of a summer compliance buyout, the pressure's upped. He's gotten paid, now he has to step up. Maybe I'm misremembering here. Didn't he have an okay playoff last year? Let me double check this.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he did.
Twenty games, 15 points, and I think he was also pretty good in that series against the Capitals in the semifinals. Yeah. It's not as if he's done nothing. It's just that he's done nothing this series.
And the problem is when you start to see that with someone his age, you say to yourself, okay, is this the beginning of the drop off?
Right.
If he's 23 years old, like people have pointed out here on Twitter, oh, well, you know, the Bruins won a cup with Tyler Seguin, so they won that trade. Well, I would respectfully submit he didn't do much that Stanley Cup year. Sure, he had the big game against Tampa, but it wasn't as if he was a factor like Zdeno Chara was or Tim Thomas was. He wasn't one of the big game players. He happened to be on the Boston Bruins, much like Thomas Cabrera happened to be on the Boston Bruins when they won the Stanley Cup. But when you apply it to the Brad Richards situation, unlike Tyler Seguin, you can still say there's a huge road ahead of him right now. We'll see how he develops. But with Brad Richards, you're taking a guy that's getting into his mid-30s and saying to yourself, is this where, you know, the ball of yarn starts to unravel for Brad Richards? Don't know. It's one bad year. It's one bad year, and I get that. But when you're that age, the one bad year usually spells doom.
All right, two more real quick. Babby Deutscher writes in, Boston, when an over in three series turns into a maybe in seven, there's going to be some explaining to do. With the 2011 Cup win, they seem to have had some leniency last year, but Boston doesn't seem like the kind of city to be okay with two first-round exits. And
there's
finally,
something missing there from the Bruins. I just don't know what it is. You look at him and you say there's something that's just not there.
Yeah, now I'll tell you exactly what it is. It's Jágr. I mean, Jágr was supposed to be Recky, and he's not.
Well, here's the problem with Jágr. He's an east-west guy who's playing with two north-south guys, Rich Peverly and Chris Kelly. They're flying straight lines, and he's like, what's this straight lines nonsense? He's always been best when he has someone that can find him the puck in unique situations. I keep going back to Michael Leland with the Rangers. He's great with him.
If the Bruins lose the series, I can't wait to have the post-mort on what Aginla would have meant for this team, by the way. Keith Hagel, I'd say it's a tie between all three members of the Bruins' second line, Bergeron, Sagan, and Marchand. They're the best line in the NHL at times, but they've done nothing in the series, especially after the thank you Sagan chance last night. Someone needs to light a fire under them. I say again, it's Marchand. All due respect to Sagan. He's put up his shots, but again, Marchand, two straight postseasons, a guy that we all thought was going to be this constant playoff performer after the way he performed when they won the cup, couldn't do it. And there you go.
And correct me if I'm wrong here, Greg Mrozinski, but didn't Brad Marchand lead the Bruins in scoring this year?
He did. 18 goals.
And in points, too, right?
18 goals. 18 goals. All right.
36 points. 36 points.
Thank you.
Playoffs.
All right, everybody. That's a show for today. I am Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
You had to think about that for a second, eh? You okay? I've always said this about you, Wish. You're a nice bunch of guys. You're a nice bunch of guys.
I was reading a stat from the Ranges.
That states that
Brad Richards, I believe, is 4-0 in Game 7s.
So they're not going to play him tonight to keep that streak alive?
That's funny. Oh, yeah, who's your pick tonight? You picking the Rangers?
I'm picking Caps and Bruins. I'm picking both home teams. But my picks. They're terrible.
I picked the Rangers. Hey, I picked the Rangers in 7 before the series. I'll pick the Rangers in 7 here, and I'll take the Leafs.
Oh, jeez. Not the city's ready for that type of explosion.
I don't think so either, but Reimer is locked. He is locked in right now. You know that.
He is. They needed that.
I mean, the Lucic goal last night was fluky McFlukerson at the end of that game, and they
great pass by Jágr. Great pass by Jágr, though.
Yeah, but still, it's an end-of-the-game goal in a game where there's a two-goal lead. Reimer's locked in. Reimer has been ridiculous the last two games.
It's that save.
I believe, Leafs Nation. I believe in your magic. Leafs at 7.
Preach on, brother. Preach
Play
on,
the parade.
Brother Wyshynski, preach on. It's that save against Bergeron. Still is good. You know, we talked about the Patrick Elias save in the New Jersey game where the net became his. That going to be the save we look at and we say that sort of put James Reimer into an even different category of a money playoff goaltender? Getting ahead of myself, but when you look back at it, that Bergeron save on Friday was stupid good.
It's Reimer, good. Reimer, getting down on Reimer. All right. Everybody, enjoy the games tonight. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks to Scott Morrison from Sportsnet for joining us. And we will see you tomorrow where we will do full playoff preview of the next round.
Wow.
And that's it. We'll talk to you soon. Bye. Thank you.